came out recently. And in terms of the broader theoretical question that this book examines, is why after the Cold War did you see the emergence of so many countries with tyrannical regimes in countries that otherwise lack what we consider standard democratic prerequisites? So these were economically underdeveloped, had weak rules of law, and faced relatively weak external pressure for democracy. And indeed, after the Cold War, you had a doubling of the share of democracies among less developed countries. So you had really a surge of these sort of democracies without prerequisites, as Stephen Fishman called them. And to examine this question, I looked at former Soviet Union. The heart of this book is a three-case comparison of Ukraine, Moldova, and Belarus, which are, as most of you know, quite next to each other, from the same region, very similar in many ways, but they have very different democratic outcomes. Ukraine and Moldova are highly pluralistic, Belarus much less so. And so the question is basically, why are these two countries relatively democratic, whereas Belarus is not? That's the heart of the book, and then I sort of afterwards examine the rest of the former Soviet Union. But really, in terms of page numbers, Ukraine is truly both the biggest country and the biggest part of the world. Now, the standard wisdom in the literature is that democracy or pluralism emerges out of what might be called positive factors in civil society. So whenever a country has a democratic revolution, you talk about an emerging civil society. People talk about democratic leadership, well-designed institutions, or democratic culture. Now, my argument is that basically none of these things really explain why Moldova and Ukraine were so pluralistic and democratic, and much more so than any other country in the former Soviet Union. Instead, I argue that pluralism emerged out of weak, authoritarian weakness rather than the strength of democratic forces. So it's less a strong civil society, less well-designed institutions, and much more underdeveloped ruling parties, dysfunctional state, and a divided society. That's the take-home message, so I expect you to recite it after the lecture. You don't be very disappointed. So basically, the question of what explains the divergence among democratic outcomes in the former Soviet Union is being, I'm not the first one to say this. The first approach really looks at constitutional design. As some of you may know, in the social science literature, presidentialism is considered bad for democracy. Parliamentarism is considered good. This is a very developed literature. The problem is, when you apply the former Soviet Union is twofold. First, as many of you know, rules are often not followed. So it's hard to sort of have too much faith in a theory which roots itself in the advocacy of institutional rules, and institutional rules themselves are tend to be very weak. Second, oftentimes constitutions themselves are the product of authoritarianism rather than their cause. So super-presidentialism in Ukraine, and sorry, in Russia, was formed after Yeltsin had bombed Parliament. So it's really the other way around. It's not that the super-presidential constitution caused authoritarianism in Russia, it's that you bomb Parliament and you get a very authoritarian constitution. Henry Hale, my colleague, has still, in a kind of more nuanced argument, said that competition in the former Soviet Union is a function of term limits, that term limits create pluralism because it forces autocrats to leave power. I don't find this to be terribly convincing. Above all, doesn't explain why most autocrats in the former Soviet Union simply ignored term limits while others followed them. So it really kind of begs the question of why are the institutional rules followed in some cases, but not in others. Next, people have argued that civil society is what has explained, especially pluralism in Ukraine. There's been a lot of discussion of civil society in Ukraine, emerging civil society, both during the Orange Revolution in 2004, as well as more recently Euromaidan. Now, there's certainly an element of truth to this. I think, relatively speaking, I think civil society is a bit more dynamic in Ukraine than in some other places. But really, it doesn't really explain the most distinguishing fact about Ukraine, which is the fact that millions of people have come out into the streets. treat the overthrow of autocrats. In fact, most studies of autocrat of protesters show that the vast majority came out spontaneously rather than being organized by any kind of civil society, student, or other organization. So there's really not much evidence that civil society per se explains these very spectacular crowds both in 2004 and 2014. And also work by Mark Weisenberg, very sophisticated statistical analysis by Mark Weisenberg at Princeton, he also showed that civil society doesn't really explain a turnout at these mass protests. Next, democracy in Ukraine is oftentimes explained by democratic culture. So you have this sort of argument that you have Cossack democracy in Ukraine versus more collective mentality in Belarus. And I don't find this terribly convincing. First of all, if you look at support for democracy in Belarus and in Ukraine, it's about the same. And furthermore, Ukrainian protesters, as Mark Weisinger shows, actually in 2004 were not particularly supportive of democracy, surprisingly enough. But they actually more opposed multi-party democracy in 2004 than supported it. So it's not really obvious that they were, you know, necessarily, you know, out there to sort of support democracy per se. Finally, a very common theory is to say, well, what, maybe it's about democratic leadership. Maybe it's because, you know, leaders in Ukraine and Moldova just were nicer people, less authoritarian. I don't find this terribly convincing, because basically you have to believe that somehow all eight leaders of Moldova and Ukraine were coincidentally more democratic than in Belarus. That's a lot of leaders, and, you know, maybe they all were nice people, but, you know, Yanukovych was not particularly nice. Really stretching it, call him nice, that's really kind of stretching. Someone who beats up his ministers, that's not very nice. Okay, so I don't think that sort of the standard wisdom, you know, some of them are part of the way, they're not completely irrelevant, but they really don't explain this variation in outcome between Moldova and Ukraine on one side and Belarus on the other. Instead, I argue that these Ukraine and Moldova are examples of what we call pluralism by default. These are cases where political competition emerges out of weak authoritarian institutions rather than democratic strength. It's better to see these countries as weak authoritarian regimes rather than as emerging democracies. So to understand the sort of intuition behind pluralism by default, I want to take you back to another time, 1994. I don't know how many of you recognize who this man is. Leonid Kravchuk, the first president of Ukraine. He's best known for the fact that he left power after one term. I remember attending a lecture in 1995 by Roman Skorlov, and he said the best part of Ukraine is that they have a former president. And that's the biggest sign of success. And indeed, you know, that is, you know, the peaceful turnover of power, which is quite remarkable. The problem is, if you look closely, it becomes much more complicated. Now, Kravchuk was nice enough to publish memoirs in 2002 in which he describes this turnover. And what he tells us, by the news, is that he actually tried to cancel the election in 1994. He agreed to elections, and he said, let this election stuff. So let's delay it. So he actually had already agreed on a date when he was going to announce on television when the election was going to be canceled, he was going to shut down Parliament, and then sort of imagine that sort of felt like, you know, like classic transition to authoritarianism. But then he met with the security officers in the military in Ukraine, and they basically said, our soldiers haven't been paid. There's no way they can actually carry this out. So he backed down. And they held elections, and he lost them to remain at Kravchuk. And the rest of history. So in other words, Ukraine's first democratic turnover was not a function of democratic leadership. I mean, he wanted to handle elections. It was not a function of a strong institution. It was the fact that the state was dysfunctional and weak. So it's a really different way of understanding pluralism than we typically see. Okay, so basically I argue that three different factors, underdeveloped voting party, weak authoritarian state, and divided national identity in the region have contributed to pluralism. First, underdeveloped ruling party, basically means the existence or absence of a single well-developed ruling party. Next, weak authoritarian state. Now, this is, by state here, I don't mean the warm, fuzzy state, the kind of state that distributes health care or that, you know, provides education. I'm talking about the
the horrible repressive state that cracks down the population and shoots people. Right? And basically, what I'm arguing is that when you don't have a well-funded security apparatus where soldiers aren't paid or police aren't paid, that contributes to pluralism, and also where state control over the economy is relatively weak, that also contributes to pluralism. Finally, the third factor is a divided national identity. What I mean here basically is our national identities that are divided between two relatively equal and politically settling groups, basically where each, in essence, of East-West Ukraine before 2014, where each side is positively gained power, so this is not like, tiny breakaway region versus the rest of the country, but in places like Ukraine or Bangladesh. If anybody wants to talk, I can talk endlessly about Bangladesh if you're interested. It's a fascinating country. There are huge similarities between Bangladesh and Ukraine, but nonetheless. Okay, so basically, the argument here is that, the lack or underdevelopment of ruling parties contributes to elite defection, which strengthens the opposition challenges. Next, we have a weak authoritarian state. Basically, these states lack the capacity, as in the example I opened up with Kachuk, to basically steal elections or crack down on opposition. And finally, a divided national identity, basically, because national identity is often so emotive and sort of people are very passionate about national identity, it makes it much easier for opposition to vocalize on each side against the incumbent, whoever they may be. So this basically introduces passion into politics, which makes it easier for opposition to mobilize, even when they face oppression or there's a weak civil society. Okay, so the book basically is about these two cases, Belarus, Moldova, and Ukraine, and I cover two parts. The first is, cross case, why Moldova and Ukraine were more democratic than Belarus? And second, within case, why do you see changes over time? And I'm arguing that my argument basically explains both of these. In a nutshell, difference in national divisions explains cross case. Within case, you see changes over time in state and party capacity. So first, a variation of cross case. As many of you in this room probably know, both Ukraine and Moldova have been relatively divided. Countries between Russophiles and Ukrainophiles in Ukraine, and between Russophiles and Europeanists and Romanians in Moldova. And basically what these divisions did was that in the early 1990s they contributed to really profound nationalist mobilization, which in turn led to the partial destruction of the authoritarian state. So in Ukraine, you see the emergence of regional power structures controlled by Rukh, the nationalist Rukh, which basically made it impossible, even if Kravchuk wanted to crack down on opposition in Lviv, in Western Ukraine, because he didn't control the state there. The police would simply not have followed the orders. Over a longer period of time, what you also find is that leads to a relatively stable, ready-made opposition between Russophiles and Ukrainophiles. Parties in Ukraine until 2014 could easily be sort of classified along these lines. There's been a lot of stuff about, is Ukraine divided into two or one, nine different divisions, whatnot. I'm happy to discuss that, but crudely speaking, it is useful, politically speaking, to make this distinction between East and West Ukraine, although it is a simplification. And it actually is no longer divided in the same way today, after the war with Russia, than it was before the war with Russia. So I can discuss that. Happy to discuss that later. Okay. So basically, the argument here is that, first we look at, the four turnovers that occurred in Ukraine, the three in Moldova, each has basically, been from one national, side of the national divide to the other. So all turnovers and ruling coalitions have been between these different sides. And in the mass mobilization in both countries in 1989-91 and in Ukraine in 1993-2004 and 2013-2014, there's a profound role for regional identity. So, crudely speaking, basically both the Orange Revolution in 2004 and the Euromaidan in 2014 were dominated by people from both Kiev, as well as Western Ukraine. So this was, and all sorts of studies have shown that Ukrainian speakers were dominated.
speaking Ukraine and really predict participation in these protests. So these were really, the size of these protests, and this has been shown in a number of different studies by a number of different surveys, was really predicated and encouraged by these national divisions, much more than support for democratic values. So that really explains why you have in Ukraine turnovers in these years. 1993, when Kravchuk lost power was because of striking miners in eastern Ukraine. So again, it was a very regionalized protest. By contrast, Belarus has been a much more weakly divided identity. Basically what happens in Belarus, Lukashenko comes to power. He quickly centralizes power. He basically neuters the parliament. And opposition, in contrast to Ukraine, is completely unable to muster support. And his sort of Russophile nature of the population after 1996, allows him also to gain significant support from Russia. So the extent to which Lukashenko has been able to consolidate authoritarian rule in Belarus, I think, is strongly related to the country's Russophile identity, and sort of relatively unified Russophile identity. So next we see, so that's puzzle one, the variation between Belarus and Ukraine on one side, Moldova and Ukraine on one side and Belarus on the other. The other puzzle is over time. So in both cases we see variation over time. In Belarus, Belarus was much more democratic and pluralistic in the early 1990s than later. And in Moldova and Ukraine you see shift between, over the course of the 1990s, Ukraine is especially complicated. Has had the most turnovers. And by the way, I have all sorts of indicators that I measure competition that are in the appendix. So Jamie will read them to you after the lecture because he's nice enough. He's a good enough friend that he bought the book. Okay. So basically, what we find in Belarus is initially. After the fall of the Soviet Union, Belarus emerges, relatively weak state here in many ways, very similar to Moldova and Ukraine. And what happens under Lukashenko is that Lukashenko actively rebuilds centralized control of the economy. A lot of my book is the story of this rebuilding through various institutions. He basically Gorbachev in the late 80s had basically destroyed the centralized control of the economy, the party was decimated under. So Lukashenko comes to power and really makes an effort at institution building. This kind of authoritarian institution building has been generally ignored in the literature because we tend to have focused on the nice institution building, writing constitutions, building courts. But there's also this other sort of dark, bad institution building that occurred and very few people have paid attention to it. One, because it's hard to find out about it, right? And two, because this is not how we think of it. We tend to sort of think in somewhat sociological terms that we want, we look for what we want to, see. But I think we need to pay attention to the sort of dark forms of state government. A really nice example in Belarus, or sort of interest, not nice, but very not nice example in Belarus in the early 1990s. Ukraine and Moldova, more or less, the differences between these high and medium competition is a function of the degree to which you have. The ruling coalition is organized on a single ruling party or not, so that when you have Yanukovych who emerges to power with a relatively united and cohesive by Ukrainian standards, party of regions, he's able to use this party to really clamp down on competition. Similarly, in Moldova, the emergence of a relatively cohesive communist party in 2001 also allowed that to sort of establish much greater degree authoritarianism. When you have you don't have such a party as under Kravchuk or under Yushchenko, that leads directly, and I make a real effort to sort of show how these organizational forms contribute to higher competition in the case study. And I think it seems pretty clear that competition in Ukraine is really a function of the organization of the coalition, whether or not it's organized into.
So that's basically the book. Hope you like it. How does this apply to the rest of the course? My editor said that I only had 200 pages of text. I said, what about Russia? I cover Ukraine. Ukraine was 150 pages, so I cut it down to 50 pages. So I'm pretty impressed with myself. The rest of the form is something I think there's sort of at least initial evidence that it sort of fits the argument. First of all, this is sort of the lesson for the opinion. What we have here is the Freedom House score, the lower the score, the more democratic, the higher the score, less democratic. These are the number of turnovers. This is the key to the blue coalition. When a figure from outside of the regime comes to power. So this kind of gives you a sense of now what we first notice is that clearly my variables aren't the only thing going on. That there's Central Asia, there's a big regional factor. Central Asia is overall much more short term than is the Russian movement. However, within these regions, you see a rough correlation between incumbent capacity and national identity and wealth of pluralism, so within the Western forms of the both split, pluralism has much deeper split, national identity is more authoritarian. In Armenia, we have the way I quote the variables are all, none of them sort of have a split in identity. But you see a sharp, really clear correlation between these. What does that mean? The origin, which is by far the weakest state, has the greatest degree of pluralism, whereas Armenia and Azerbaijan have a far more state than the U.S. Central Asia is more or less helpfully worse. Tajikistan, who does not look from our region, have very good state, that works. Sometimes these don't work. What do you do? I try to talk to them that they weren't doing democratic, but my argument is here. But more specifically, I look at all 27 incumbents in the former Soviet Union, and we find that among those incumbents backed by a relatively weak party state or have a highly divided identity, very few of these incumbents survive more than two terms. 3 of 16, the exceptions are Boris Yeltsin in the 1990s and some others. By contrast, those incumbents backed by a relatively strong party or state and with a weakly divided identity tend to survive for much longer. They tend to be much more durable. So 9 of 11 incumbents with strong party state and less divided national identity survive for more than two terms, or gave power to someone within the regime. So this is correlation, it's not causation, it's just simply but this gives you a sense that it perhaps works. I do sort of, in the book, provide some very basic case studies, that there is actually substantive case study evidence to support this. We also see some evidence over time, so it's interesting if you compare the impact of versus authoritarian strength, they come up with conflicting expectations. So civil society was obviously, very repressed during the Soviet era, during the totalitarian era. So we might expect that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, so these, places are still authoritarian, but much less repressive than in the Soviet Union, that over time, as the civil society got stronger, got more experienced, you see an increase in democracy. Whereas, from my perspective, you think, the opposite, that sort of over time, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you see a gradual increase in state party strength, and that should lead to a decrease in democracy, and indeed, you see a stark decrease in democracy in almost all post-Soviet cases, and indeed, specific cases are very clear, like in Azerbaijan, there's real state building, as well as Russia, real state building that, directly can be shown to lead to the reduction of democracy. So there's, again, some preliminary evidence that basically pluralism emerges out of failure of the 1840s rather than out of the 19th, like the society or well designed institution. Okay. So to conclude,
to understand democratization, we need to look at not just at quote the forces we like, civil society, development, well-designed institutions, but the strength of authoritarian institutions. In other words, that we have to actually examine, does the leader have the capacity to impose authoritarian rule or not? And it's oftentimes not. And then basically, all good things don't go together. That's what I'm going to try to tell my kids, but they don't believe me. That we have nice things like pluralism, but it actually emerged to an important extent out of state failure. And that what promotes competition may also undermine economic reform and long-term democratic development. And pluralism by default, while they're more democratic, are not really nice places to live. There you go. Thank you very much.